Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Among our topics, a plan for a $1 billion stadium, a plan for a $1 billion jail, and public schools potentially on the chopping block. Plus, the sheriff is sued after a suspect is strip searched in the street, and the latest in the trial of a couple charged with the contract killing of Jared Bridegan. To talk about all that and more, I'm joined by Keitha Nelson of First Coast News, anchor of Good Morning Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Keitha. Ben Becker, anchor and investigative reporter at Action News. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ann. I'm glad I made it here to my tea time, unlike Scotty Scheffler.
So true.
The shade.
Also joined by longtime political consultant and former political reporter, John Daigle. Hey, John.
Good morning, Ann.
And attorney and former Jacksonville City Council President Jack Webb.
Thank you for having me back. Good morning.
Thanks for arriving, all of you, early and being here on a Friday. Ben, I want to start with you because you've been reporting some of the details of the stadium renovation plan even before it was unveiled on Tuesday night. Why was it being kept under wraps in this way?
That's a great question, Ann. This is something that there's been a big question about transparency in this whole situation that I've been digging into for really months. Even up until the last few weeks before the announcement came, I put a request in public records with the mayor's office for the minutes of meetings that have taken place for discussions of the stadium, and I was told there were no official meetings. So official meetings. Okay, so I said, then can you provide notes? And they said, well, notes aren't public records. So then we have all these discussions, meetings that didn't exist on a stadium worth more than $1 billion, and then when they did decide they had a deal, it came out that it's nothing on paper yet, and we had to wait until Tuesday. So up until Tuesday, over months, really years, because my request went back even to the Curry administration, plus the Deegan administration, there's nothing they could provide me. So why it was kept under wraps, you have to ask the Deegan administration and the Curry administration as to why. I would guess they like to keep the negotiations private.
So you were able to find out some information. We obviously learned a lot more on Tuesday night. And so this is a massive project, the biggest that the city would undertake really in its history.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're talking, depending on how you want to look at the numbers, $1.25 billion, $1.4 billion, $1.7 billion. You know, it depends how you want to slice it. The end of the day is this. Mayor Deegan has said this is not a tax increase to pay for the stadium. And, you know, they're shuffling a lot of money around. You have the capital improvement plan, the Better Jacksonville plan. It gets very confusing whether it's, you know, BJB, the CIP, or now the ABCs, okay? And the bottom line is this. This could be Mayor Deegan's read my lips, no new taxes moment. Is this a new tax or not? I've talked to economists. I've talked to members of city council. And basically the thought is this. If you're borrowing money, if you're paying 5 to 6% interest on that money over a 30-year period, whatever way you want to slice it, in their view, this is a new tax, period. Their opinion.
Jack Webb, I want to ask you about that. I mean, the city, it might surprise people to know, it kind of surprised me to learn that really anytime the city is building something in its capital improvement plan, it's really kind of borrowing that money. It takes it from city coffers and then it borrows money to pay back. So there is a lot of debt that the city accrues. Does that, in your mind, constitute a tax?
Actually, no, it doesn't. I mean, I think, you know, ultimately, in order to fund the contributions of the CIP, capital improvement plan, the money's got to come from somewhere. So it's either going to come from general revenue or it's going to come from debt. Okay. Now, if it's going to come from general revenue, that means you've got, my understanding, and based on your story, Ben, that I saw, was that the first 5 years you got $600 million that's going to be funded from the CIP from what, general revenue? Is that's a $200 million annual hit to the CIP? That means a lot of other projects that are going to get swallowed up. So I doubt very much whether or not. So in order to supplement that, you're going to have to float debt, and then you're going to have to float. You're going to have to make your debt service. You're going to have to cover that, and or you're going to have to just directly fund the CIP, and you're going to have to do that through taxation. So ultimately, you're going to need more money. Mm-hmm. You're going to need more money.
And the taxpayers pay for that at the end of the day.
Absolutely. You're going to have to raise the ad valorem is what it comes down to.
So even if it's not a tax now in your mind, you believe at some day, some point in time, it is a tax in another way, shape, or form.
You're going to have to pay the piper eventually. That's correct.
Well, John, in the long term, what they want to do is, you know, extend the current timeline for when the Better Jacksonville plan would sort of resolve and turn into a pension funding source. So it would extend the life of this tax, this half penny tax, in order to kind of shift things around in the budget. But it wouldn't necessarily be a new tax to taxpayers. It would be extending a tax.
Well, I certainly agree with the idea that if you look at it, it's more expense. And ultimately, taxpayers are going to have to foot it, whether that's a new tax or an extended tax. But I mean, I think there's few people who doubt that the deal is going to get done. And it's going, you know, the new stadium is going to get built, despite, you know, there is a little bit of consternation in the public now. And there's people making some arguments. I remember I was at the Times Union in 95 when the original deal went through and we were debating over $120 million. And there was a ton of consternation about that. At one point, Wayne Weaver threw in the towel and went back to Connecticut. But the deal ultimately got done. And that's what I think will happen here. I think that the key thing at this point is to make sure that the public understands the deal and that we've done our due diligence.
And so, Keith, this has been, as Ben alluded to, there's been a long time, you know, of negotiations in sort of behind closed doors. But then, you know, the rollout came this week formally. How do people think the mayor did and the Jaguars in presenting this deal to the public and making the case for this big expense?
Well, we're hearing backlash, of course, as expected, right? Everyone wants to know about the money in the long run. How are we going to pay for this? You talk about increasing taxes. That's all people want to know about. And also the area surrounding the stadium. John just said it. The deal looks like it's likely done. So let's talk about who it's going to actually benefit. Mm-hmm. The area surrounding the stadium, the east side, has been neglected for so many years. Exactly how are they going to benefit? You have all of these businesses as well that are sometimes struggling to make it. You know, what's going to happen to them? And a lot of them are concerned about these games that are going to no longer be in our area during this construction, right? The downtown businesses that rely on these games that come to Jacksonville, the Florida Georgia game as well. When that is not here during the renovations, what's going to happen to those businesses? So they're going to have to get creative, figure out how to actually continue to bring in revenue during that time.
And at the same time, Keith, there are a lot of amenities that people have been demanding, more bathrooms, wider concourses. And that is something that, you know, it's going to come with a hefty price tag to make those kind of changes, including a roof.
Yeah, that's just it. So what's going to happen? Again, it goes right back to the situation when it comes to taxes. Will we be taxed? We'll be seeing that happen in the end. But we're just going to have to wait and see what happens.
So there is the question of how this is going to look and the eventuality. Jaguars president Mark Lamping directly tackled that topic during the rollout on Tuesday.
This is what people want to see in the stadium. They want to see shade on all the seats. They want to have improved airflow, cover from rain, easier to get from level to level, wider concourses, more and better restrooms, more and upgraded concessions, including local food offerings, more air-conditioned space. By the way, the renderings that you see will be memorialized as part of our agreement with the city. What you see is what will be built.
Ben.
Well, first off, when I was driving in today and I saw saw Daly's Place across the street, I thought back to what we thought Daly's Place was going to look like and what it looks like today, an airplane hangar, but I digress. So I want to talk about this. The economists I've spoken with, and I've talked to a number of them, they talk about why owners of NFL teams want new stadiums. And one of the things that they put out there, they want to increase or improve the fan experience. And Mark Lamping just kind of addressed that. What they say is improving the fan experience is not number one, number two, or number three. Their goals, number one, number two, and number three, are to make as much money as possible for their teams. And that's creating new revenue streams for their teams. Okay. The mayor talked the other day about creating $26 billion in economic impact over 30 years of the stadium. The economists say economic impact is not revenue. Okay. It's two separate things. Jacksonville Today did a great article the other day talking about the revenue from the stadium, okay? And what it said is the stadium over the last 3 years is actually in the red when you talk about the money it brings in. Also with the debt service, it's about $100 million in the hole over the last 3 years, okay? So you talk about economic impact, it ain't happening there. And when you also talk about economic impact, basically what that means is, okay, there's new money being spent. Well, if I'm supposed to take my wife out to a dinner and a movie, and instead we go to a Jags game, besides her not being happy with me, the other part of that equation will be that it's just shifting money from the right hand to the left hand. That is not new spending. That is not economic impact. But as part of these equations, as part of these methodologies, it gets included as such.
Interesting. Jack Webb.
Well, you know, I get what Ben's saying, and I hear you, but I think you do have to distinguish between direct economic impact and indirect economic impact. I don't think anybody would suggest that Jaguars probably have not been a good thing for the city of Jacksonville over the last 30 years. I mean, I got here when the Jaguars got here. Graduated from law school that same year, so I kind of grew up with them here in Jacksonville. I think we are where we are. I mean, as you said in your story the other day, I think it was one of the economists you were talking to said, hey, it's cost of doing business with the NFL. We could either choose to do this deal or not do this deal. And I think the city's come a long way, you know, in that regard. Apparently we're going to do the deal. I will give hats off to the Jaguars as with regards to the marketing campaign. That is, they've gotten out in front of it and they're selling it to the community. And yet we've yet to see an ordinance be delivered to the city council for purposes of the council auditor doing a deep dive into what the numbers really look like.
Well, the council auditor will be doing that deep dive. But I think the Jags learned their lesson from Lot J.
Absolutely.
And how that was fumbled, if you will, at the goal line.
Well, so Donna Deegan, the mayor, made a pretty strong and personal pitch for this. Actually speaking to reporters after that presentation, let's hear a little of what she had to say.
Listen, I was sitting on the anchor desk at First Coast News on November 30th of 1993 when we got the announcement that Jacksonville had done the impossible, frankly. As a fifth generation native, I get real irritated with people that don't give Jacksonville its due. And I have always believed in this city, and I think a lot of folks have a tough time believing in themselves in this city. And that was a seminal moment for us. It was such a shot in the arm for the city. To believe and to know that we could actually land this deal. And while nobody wants to spend a lot of money, the truth is this was a binary choice. We can build a stadium or we could lose our team. And that's not going to happen on my watch.
John Daigle.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I look at this as an economic investment perspective, like Ben was talking about, it's hard to argue that it makes sense. It'll bring the return on investment back. But you also have to look at it as an investment in quality of life and in the city. I think about spending $1 billion of tax revenue on the 70,000, 80,000 people who come there for games over the year. And maybe over the course of a year, 1 million people may come in or out of the stadium. But compare that. We're going to talk later in this segment about the new jail. And we're talking about spending $1 million for a new jail where only about 40,000 people a year come in or out of that jail.
A billion for a new jail.
Yeah. And so it's the cost that we're talking about spending on the new stadium of tax dollars is comparable to what we're talking about spending on a new jail. Some things you invest in for just quality of life in the city, and they don't necessarily have a dollar for dollar economic return on investment.
And you're saying that the jail is an example of which?
Jail is something the community has to do for our general quality of life. You know, again, 40,000 people, you know, mostly folks who have been charged with crimes come in or out of there. It certainly does not have a return on investment, but it's something we have to do as a community.
We're talking about the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Week in Review panel. And you can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. We can take a call here from Herman in St. John's. Good morning, Herman. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ann and gang. I'm going to ask my question and get out of here. I'm having a real hard time hearing you in my headset. But as a longtime Jacksonville, as they like to say, Duval kind of resident, I'm a little bit surprised that I have not heard any of the council people or even any of my fellow journalists ask the question. The chamber advertises Jacksonville as a 7-county radius. And when we look at places like JEA and the city, most of Duval residents live in the 7-county radius. Why and if the 7-county radius, St. John's, Clay, Nassau, Baker, are going to contribute any dollars to this, and especially with places like Amelia Island being the number one island in the world that attracts as many people as they do, are they going to help us with this debt?
Thanks, Herman. Keith, I mean, it's, you know, obviously there is a lot of there are a lot of people that come to Jacksonville mm-hmm. for work, live elsewhere. But this is the city that's negotiating with the Jaguars. It's not Amelia Island. It's not Clay County. Yeah. It's the city.
You just said it. But back to the soundbite we just heard with Donna. I remember interviewing her. I remember interviewing her before she became mayor, right, during the campaign trail. And she said just that, is that this was not going to be fumbled on her watch. It's a huge deal. We do not want to lose our Jacksonville Jaguars. And I heard that interview with The Economist that you did, Ben. And she said it. This is the price of business. This is what is going to be done. And it looks as if this deal, like it or not, it looks like it's done. So again, who's it going to benefit? And I'm going to bring it right back to that Eastside community right outside of the stadium. We need to be paying attention to that. How is this going to benefit
What's
them?
Interesting about the deal is, you know, that outside the stadium component is really separate from the renovation deal. So the Jaguars renovation deal could be approved, and yet there's this $300 million component that may or may not accompany the deal.
We can't lose sight of that, though.
Mm-hmm.
We can't.
Jack, there's been a lot of pushback already from city council members who have traditionally been on the other side of things.
Right.
How focused are they going to be on this element that perhaps is more flexible, malleable, or removable?
Well, I was going to go there. I think you need to make certain that it's linked and it has teeth, because anything you can negotiate, you can legislate away anything with 10 votes. So got to make certain that it's locked in. It's locked. And that's kind of hard to do in our form of government, because people have such short-term memories. You know, you come up with a reason not to do something 5 years down the road, and there goes your funding source. And, you know, all these promises that were made. And, you know, we're pretty good at that here in Duval, right?
Yeah. That's right.
So, yeah.
We've got a call from Omar. Go ahead. Good morning, Omar.
Good morning. I think that an investment in the schools that they're closing would be a better for the quality of life of people in Jacksonville. If you're using taxpayer money, you should be adding to the economic wealth of the area that you're in. So that's my comment.
Thanks, Omar. That, you know, maybe gives us an opportunity to shift a little bit, Keith, to the topic of schools. You know, it sort of dovetails into this topic. The city council is a separate body, obviously. They don't have jurisdiction over the schools, but it's not hard for people to view these things side by side. We've got a whole question of, you know, as many as 30 schools that could be on the chopping block for closure.
So the thing is that when you look at it on paper, it makes sense to whoever's looking at it, right? You have this huge debt that the school system can't seem to fill. So why not consolidate schools where they don't have as many students, where the need is not there, or so it appears. But in reality, you have people connected to these schools, communities connected to these schools, and people are passionate about their communities, right? I mean, I've been to these meetings. I get the phone calls, the emails. Folks are angry about this. They have deep ties to these schools. But it appears, and then there's the fear, because even though they're having all of these community meetings where we can all talk about it, about the possibilities, the fear is that the decision is already made. You know, you're just hearing people complain just for the sake of it. So that's what I'm hearing, the fear. But we're going to have to see how it all pans out in the end. But again, on paper, it looks like it makes sense. But you have to think about people.
Yeah.
You have to think about the people.
And those people showed up this week, John, while a lot of the attention and the oxygen in the room was kind of swallowed up by this Jaguars announcement, there were dozens of people in yellow shirts, kids and parents, at the city council meeting there to represent in opposition of school closures.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really personal issue. I mean, a lot of people, my wife and I, when we bought our house, we shopped first for schools and we found the school we wanted to put our kids in. Then we bought a house in that neighborhood. A lot of people have major investments in real estate based on the neighborhood schools. And so it's a very personal, very emotional issue, and there's going to be a ton of outcry as the list becomes more and more final. But, you know, I think a lot of local journalists have done a good job of reminding people, all those who are supporting the Florida's expanding voucher system, you know, that's very much at the root of what's going on here. And it just really gets me when a lot of the people who are showing up to protest these school closings are the same people who have supported the voucher system year and year and year, and now they're not making that connection of this is the result of what's happening in our public schools with the voucher system.
Right, and so vouchers basically allow parents to take that money that would otherwise go to public schools and take it with them and apply it to a private school if they choose, or whatever kind of schooling they're choosing, even if it's homeschooling.
Yeah. I mean, funding for each school is based on enrollment. And as more children leave public, traditional public schools and go to charters, that money follows them.
And yet, Jack, this narrative that we're hearing from the school district is so different than what voters were told a couple years ago when they approved, you know, a tax increase to fund new construction. There's a bunch of schools that are already under construction. And now there's so much attrition in terms of attendance. They're revising everything. Construction costs have nearly doubled.
Yeah, I understand that. What bothers me about this is that this discussion, I don't think this discussion should even be occurring right now, because we don't have a school board person. We don't have a school board supervisor, right? We have an interim. Okay. Where is the strategic long-term plan? We're making long-term strategic decisions that are going to impact the social fabric of the city of Jacksonville in long-term based on what? All right, let's figure out, let's put it all on a shelf right now and take a deep breath. But I honestly believe that when you're talking about these schools, you're talking about neighborhood schools. When you're talking about shutting down a neighborhood school, you're going to have impact, adverse impact on those very communities. These are this again, it's going to affect the social fabric of the entire community. So I think this is something, I don't know if the Deegan administration wants to risk additional political capital on this thing, but given the absence of leadership at the schools, Duval County Public Schools, I really believe that this is not just a school board discussion to be had. This is a community discussion that I think that the mayor and the city council need to speak on as well.
Well, Ben, we talk about economic impact in terms of the Jaguars. Does anybody ever calculate the economic impact to a neighborhood if they lose, for instance, their neighborhood school?
That's a great point. Think about it. We're having this discussion about, well, we have to give the Jags this money. The Jags have to get it. We don't want to lose the Jags. Well, do we want to lose schools? Mm-hmm. Now, they're separate buckets, they'll say. Nothing's stopping the city, though, starting having another half-cent sales tax if they wanted to help support schools. Could they add another? You know, is that a possibility?
Extend it.
Right. Could you make it different? So, you know, we have to make a decision as a community. What is more important? Is it subsidizing billionaires or subsidizing children? And can you do both, or you have to pick one? And which is it going to be if you have to pick one, right? What is the economic impact of a better educated community down the line versus subsidizing billionaire team owners? Which benefits more?
It's an interesting...
I'll lay it out. I report, you decide.
Yeah.
As they say.
I mean, it's an interesting question, Keith. One of the schools, John Stockton Elementary, that is on the list of potential closures was ranked last year by U.S. News and World Report as the country's second best elementary school. It seems surprising.
So how painful is that? So you saying that, how painful is that to the educators within that school, to the students within that school, to the parents whose kids go to that school, to the community surrounding that school, knowing that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jack.
Why would you even think about it, right? If that's what you've got here, why don't you go down, shut down Stanton while you're at it? You know, I mean, come on. I mean, really? It makes absolutely no sense in the long term.
On paper.
On paper it does. So what are you going to do? You're going to consolidate, right? Consolidate schools into newer buildings, right? Okay, so you're losing the character of the community school as well, neighborhood school. And then what are you doing? That's over. You're going to put them back in trailers? And modular units. I mean, what are you going to do? Yeah. I mean, it's just, again, it's a short-term fix. It's addressing a short-term funding situation, or maybe it's a long-term funding situation, but you're going to have to figure it out in any event, right? I mean, it's talking about the viability of public education in Duval County. So you're going to have to figure it out. So you're not doing yourself any favor by putting a bullet in your prizes, right? In the prized assets.
And I remember when the half-cent sales tax came out initially and Dr. Diana Green was pushing for it, and the Curry administration was against it. But then when the amount of money that would go to charter schools became larger, lo and behold, the Curry administration was on board, and the both of them were doing commercials pushing the plan. If the tax had remained the way it would have been, way it was intended to be, we probably wouldn't be having that discussion today. So as you pointed out earlier, this is this is where we are because of those decisions in the past.
Yeah, and I agree. And if you look big picture, this is part of the process of a long-term decades-old approach of attacking traditional public education in favor of charter schools. And I think, mark my words, the buildings that they close as traditional publics are going to reemerge as charter schools. And that was always one of the biggest problems with the charter school equation is facilities. So this is a way of solving the biggest problem in the charter school business model is paying how to get facilities. And when they close publics and convert them to charters, it solves that problem.
Yeah. And to your point, Ben, I mean, that law that was passed at the state level requires funding now to basically be divvied up between traditional public schools and charters. And so any money that's raised by the tax also has to be divvied up. We have a call from JD in Sea Island. Go ahead, JD.
Yes, this is about the stadium itself. I heard here when they first were talking about this was, why don't we move the stadium? Well, let's take a little look at all the other major metropolitan cities in North America the last 10 or 15 years. Every single one of them that's built a new stadium or moved their stadium, they moved it out next to the airport. Now, in my opinion, to take all the money you're going to take to rebuild that one in the middle of a logistics nightmare, because it was built in 1955 as the Gator Bowl, the year I was born, and it was fine then. But today, it is a logistics nightmare. Take that same money, take that whole stadium, and put it out there at the airport. It just makes more sense. Also, it solves the problem of where the Jaguars are going to play. If you are going to spend money, our taxpayers' money, let's do it in a more sensible way. Do not rebuild it where it's sitting. It is a logistics nightmare.
Thanks, JD. Appreciate it. We also have a call from Curtis on the north side. Curtis, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm listening to both sides. And the Jaguars are important, but so are the schools. They're way more important. Why won't someone talk about the fact that they want to kill the public schools for the sake of charter schools, which is a business, and just to get away from the school union? Thank you.
Thanks, Curtis. Good question, John. I want to move on to talk about another topic, another billion-dollar project, as we mentioned, the jail.
Yeah.
There's so many issues around this. Cost is obviously one of them, but so is location. Mm-hmm. So what are you hearing about that?
Well, I mean, there has been a lot of discussion about the jail, but people have to keep in mind that actually the topic involves the jail, the police memorial building, as well as the Montgomery Correctional Facility out on the north side. So it's a big project that they're contemplating. And like I said, their initial report came out with estimates over $1 billion to solve it. And it's got to happen. You just really don't have any choice about it. And it doesn't have an economic return on investment unless you look really big picture. But there hasn't been a lot of discussion yet, concrete discussion about where you're going to relocate the jail. Most people do not want it to remain downtown. There's been some media reports in the last week or two that they're looking at some city-owned land that's out at Cecil Field. I've talked to, you know, I was very involved in the fight to keep Cecil Commerce Center and not return the Navy base to it back when. I can tell you that the residents out there are ready to have that fight again. I talked to Alberta Hips this week, who was a leader in fighting against the original idea of putting the jail out at the Cecil Field property. Her message to me, you know, she's getting calls from people who are concerned about that, and she's told me she's ready to rumble. And I can tell you there's some other council members, including some who are moving into leadership positions, who are against that as well. I'm not sure legally they can put the jail out there because the contract for Cecil requires whatever's out there to generate jobs. And I don't know that you can argue that a jail is a job generator. But that's going to be, if that's ultimately where they decide, and there's a lot of people who think it's a great idea because we own the land, it's on the outskirts of town, it's out there where there are other prison facilities in in Union County. But I think there would be believe me, as someone who's been involved, the West Side is ready to fight that if that's the way it's going to go.
And Alberta Hips is a bit of a political legend in that area. She's a former city council
president. Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that the sheriff said in an interview this week was that, and this kind of surprised me, Ben, but, you know, he said that one location that they're talking about, possibly Cecil, another, the Imeson area, but he said, you know, people talk about the P farm, the prison farm, which is known as, it's formerly Montgomery Correctional on Lanny Road, as a location. But he says, no, that's not going to work because it floods there. I didn't realize that was even a problem. But it's interesting to think that location where there is a facility and it's also the firing range for JSO is so susceptible to flooding.
You know, there's only one thing that could make people more angry about giving $1 billion towards a football team. It's probably $1 billion to a jail. I'd like to see both of those on a referendum and see what would pass. What would get 60% of the vote, you think? Would either one, would both, or none? Like, what do you think?
Well, I think UNF actually did poll on that recently, and there was more support for the jail than there was for spending that money on the Jaguars.
I'm shocked.
That does surprise
me. True truth.
Did it get 60%?
I don't remember the numbers, and maybe my producer can check for that. But yeah, I believe that there was more support for the jail. And I think it had to, there is this kind of, you know, instinctual, residual sense. Why are we giving a billion dollars?
Yeah.
At least, you know, the jail, you have people who have nothing who you're subsidizing. And you know, the jail is the largest mental health facility in the city, like every city it is. And it is a necessity. You have to have a jail. So you have to do it the best way possible and hopefully get better outcomes. And I think that's one of the goals of the new jail, is to try to get better outcomes.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, that does help you as a community. That does help your economics. And there should be a benefit there. Plus, I believe they employ JSO, 2,000 people or so, give or take? Mm-hmm. So there is an impact there.
I mean, they want to employ that many. You know, it's been very hard for them to recruit and retain correctional officers, in part, they say, because the quality of the facility is a safety hazard.
Yeah, there's no question about that. The study that was done that determined that there needs to be a new jail showed that it was unsafe. It had mold there. We get the calls all the time from people who have loved ones within the jail saying that it's unsafe conditions. We've seen all of the deaths back-to-back, inmate deaths. They've been happening, not just this year, but last year again. We had several just within the beginning of the year, I remember, again, back-to-back. It needs to be done. There's no question about that, but...
And remember, too, we have a pension issue, and that's one of the reasons why they can't get people to work there, is because there's a pay and the pension was stripped away, a part of the Curry administration back, I believe it was 2019 or so, with pension reform.
Yeah.
So if there's no pension, then why do I want to work in Duval when I can go work in St. John's or Clay or some other place?
Right. We've got a call from Tom on the west side. Good morning, Tom. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning to you all, too. I just wanted to make a couple points about that infirmary. First, remember that infirmary is going to be run by the same people that are currently providing health care in the jail, and they're struggling to just keep people alive there. Second, the argument that it's going to save transportation cost by having an infirmary attached to the jail is just totally specious, because every inmate is going to need to go to the courthouse multiple times, and the transportation cost for that's going to be greater than the transportation cost of occasionally transporting a prisoner to the hospital. So that just makes no sense. And I've spoken to the city council numerous times about pursuing alternatives to mass incarceration at the jail that would allow us to refurbish the current jail and use it with smaller numbers of prisoners, and so far no one's listening.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. I want to move on now, Keitha, to a topic that was in court this week. It's a high-profile case, the murder of Jared Bridegan, a former Microsoft executive from St. Augustine. His wife and her husband are accused and facing the death penalty. But there's been some major developments recently in this case.
Yeah, just Wednesday, a 7-hour bond hearing for Shanna Gardner. It's a very convoluted case. I'm going to go ahead and explain it really quickly. So Shanna Gardner and her husband, Mario Fernandez Saldana, they are both currently involved. They are on trial right now for this murder for hire plot, they're calling it. Reads like a soap opera, quite frankly. So Shanna is trying to get this bond hearing so she can actually have bond and be able to be with her twins. She has twins with Bridegan, who was shot and killed, the St. Johns County father. And so she can't get to them right now, clearly, because she is in jail. So a decision wasn't made after 7 hours, by the way. It's now in the hands of the judge, which is London Kite. She said she was going to release a decision within the coming days, a written decision. But during the bond hearing, we heard a lot of information that wasn't made public prior to. The lead detective in the case from the Jacksonville,
Jacks Beach
Police Department, he got up there on the stand and let out so much information we had not heard regarding text messages between Shanna Gardner and her really good friend. And in those messages, you heard like nuances of them wanting someone killed. Now, the defense came back and said that they were just joking. And there are some things in particular. I'm going to let you know what they said. They said making reference to funeral potatoes, needing someone who could make magic or make someone disappear. But again, they were speaking in code during these text messages. But these are things we had never heard before prior to Wednesday's hearing. I'm going to fast forward a little bit to what's going on with Henry Tenen. Henry Tenen, in the end, he is the man who said that, yes, I did pull the trigger, right? He pleaded guilty. But the defense, who is Jose Baez, he was the same attorney for Casey Anthony, he came back and said, you cannot tie Shanna Gardner to this because Shanna never had any direct contact with Henry Tenen. And even the money that was given to Tenen in the end, or promised to him, that was signed over, it was signed by her ex-husband, not actual Shanna Gardner. So Jose Baez did a good job, some would say, on the stand by pretty much separating the two. And I know it's a very convoluted case, but it reads like a soap opera. And so much, again, came out during that 7 hours. But a decision was not made in the end.
One thing that I thought was interesting was this idea that they brought forward that, what, you know, the defendant, Mario Fernandez, that he had been tracking Jared Bridegain. They said that there was evidence to show that he had been close enough to touch him on multiple occasions. He called those, quote, missed opportunities. And they also talked about something I thought was really interesting, Ben, called a strategic leak to the media. So they said they basically leaked on purpose to the media that there was an arrest coming in this case. The man who's ultimately confessed and is going to testify against the couple, mm-hmm. In order to track their phones and their phone chatter and their text chatter amongst themselves after this leak was made public to the media. I thought that was kind of an interesting strategy.
Well, leaks happen all the time. Mm-hmm. That's the job, is to get information. Jose Baez is going to have his work cut out for him. He's going to earn every dollar in this one. You know, it's funny how these defense attorneys work. You think there's a case where someone has no chance at all. But when you listen and you're in the courtroom, you hear them do their spiel and you're like, oh, maybe they'll get off. Like, I remember sitting on Aaron Zahn trial every day and his attorneys
from JEA.
Yeah. From JEA and making the case, you know, I believe that cost $10 million, by the way, that defense. And yeah, you know, when they're giving their defense, you're like, huh, okay, maybe so. So, Baez, you know, he's done it before and we'll see if he can do it again.
Well, Jack, you're an attorney, and, you know, the rules of evidence are very specific and very strict. But the judge in this case basically pulled back some key evidence, not this week, but previously, because she was concerned about the way that the prosecution had conducted itself, basically accessing, you know, messages, text messages between two of the defendants that they should not have seen, she decided. And then some that she said were not privileged, but she was not going to let the prosecution use them because of their conduct. She's punishing them.
Well, we're live streaming here, so if you're looking at the camera, I'm looking at the camera with this feigned look of shock on my face. Okay, yeah, I mean it's pretty significant. Basically, she sanctioned the prosecution and said, "You're not, you know, listen, you're playing games. You did not comply with the rules of discovery with regards to some of this information, and I'm going to suppress it now." You know, there were other evidentiary matters or documents or whatever that were not suppressed, but she sent in a loud and clear message to the prosecutor's office on this one. So I find that very significant and kind of surprising, actually.
You think Baez is playing chess here and the prosecutors are playing checkers?
I don't want to say that.
John, this is a tough case, though. This is really high profile, and they're bringing in the big guns, as you say. For this prosecution's office, it's going to be a tall wall that they're going to confront.
It is a huge issue, and it's going to have a big impact on the state attorney's office. I've actually got a client in the state attorney's office who's running for judge, so I'm going to claim conflict on this
one. All right. Gotcha. Jack, I want to talk briefly about a case that you have brought yourself. It's a story that we've covered on this station and local media has covered pretty heavily, the case of Ronnie Reed. He's a black man who was arrested when he was 45 and strip searched in the street rather extensively, and now he's suing.
Correct. Mr. Reed contacted my office immediately after the state attorney's office had dropped the charges. And it was interesting because over the period of time between his release and the state was still trying to get him to plead to a deal where, although they had no evidence whatsoever, they still wanted him to take a 4-year plea deal. Okay, so Mr. Reed contacted us, and since that time, we filed suit on May 7th of this year. And quite honestly, Alexis Ritchie, who works with me, did a painstaking analysis of the body cam and the internal affairs investigation reports and recordings, and put together the narrative that comprises the complaint for violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. What I will say from timeline on this thing is that, as we allege in the complaint, although we named the sheriff T.K. Waters, we sue him in the lawsuit. We're suing him in his official capacity, not in an individual capacity, because ultimately the sheriff, whether it's Pat Ivey or whether it's Mike Williams, the person, the human being who sits in that chair as the constitutional officer, who's ultimately responsible for the training and the supervision of the officers who he appoints. Okay, that's the way it works. During this period of time, if you recall, the sheriff's office was kind of in a state of disarray. Ronnie was arrested on September 9th of 2022. This was after Mike Williams had resigned and Pat Ivey was the interim. But for a year prior to Mike's resignation, he had vacated the office by moving out of the county. So you've got a situation here. Put it all together. You know, who's minding the store? The constitutional officer who is responsible for this, for making certain that his officers comply with constitutional norms, didn't see fit to live in a county. How could he possibly see fit to make certain that his officers are properly doing their jobs?
According to OGC, Williams was still the sheriff, right?
Well, other minds would disagree. Again, I think it was Jason Gabriel at the time, wrote the opinion that was never issued officially, that once he moved out of the county.
I think it was Teal.
Was it Jason? Okay, it was Jason Teal.
But you're talking about the Office of General Counsel.
Sorry, Jason. But bottom line is, I think the opinion was that once he moved out of the county, he had vacated the seat. So arguably, there was a period of time where no one's minded the store. And that's a problem.
I mean, Keith, this is a case that people are watching for a couple of reasons. One is the optics, not that great. I mean, this was a pretty extensive and intimate strip search that was done in public of this adult man. But then also the fact that, despite the fact that no drugs or money were found on him during that search or later when he had a more extensive search at the jail, he was still charged, and those charges remained, as Jack said, for many, many months before they were dropped.
Yeah. You know, there's certain stories that you read and you sit back and say, oh, this person's going to file suit. This was definitely one of them when you first look at it, read it. And then they released a body camera video. You know, you see this guy in public, in a public street being strip searched. They tell him to take off his underwear, tell him to bend over, and you're seeing that in the video, all of this. So I saw it coming. I think we all did, that the lawsuit was going to be filed, and we'll see what happens.
Well, Keith Nelson, Jack Webb, Ben Becker, John Daigle, appreciate all of your thoughts on all of these good topics. Thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And up next, Songs from the Neighborhood. Mr. Al Peet shares his playlist for the weekend.
Mayo Clinic, working to predict the unpredictable by using a patient's anatomy to create 3D printed life-size organ models to map out complex surgeries. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
On the next Florida Roundup, the state spends millions of dollars on the health of moms-to-be and babies, but Florida's infant mortality rate has not changed much in a decade, and it's a higher risk for Black babies. Are you a new parent, grandparent, aunt, or uncle? Tell us about the access to health care for the newborn in your life. Email us, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Then join us Friday at noon.
This week on Science Friday, the vaccine of the future could look a lot different than the ones today.
This vaccine could be delivered to your home, and you could take a sniff of this vaccine and go back to work.
How to use nanotechnology to better prepare ourselves for the next pandemic. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
It's on for now.
Make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice.
Also, Donald Trump's former fixer is grilled in court. How soon might we get a verdict? Inflation cools, and this year's meme stock party fizzles as Wall Street hits new highs. We get to all of it on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
We got growth in abundance, learning more
every
day.
Let's go, let's go, let's go.
You can't take it away. We got
soul. Welcome back. Well, it's the weekend officially, and every Saturday, Mr. Al Pete hosts the neighborhood for the Jacksonville Music Experience at 9 o'clock on WJCT. He's here to share some songs that we're going to hear on the show this weekend. Hey, Al.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Really nice to have you here.
Thanks. Always having me. I appreciate it.
And I know you've got a busy weekend. You're performing around town at gigs.
I have 904 pop up on Sunday. That's 12 to 2. And then Emancipation event at Jamesville & Johnson. Got an event tonight, Leadership Jacks. So moving around and shaking.
Yeah. And we were talking about the Emancipation Day party and celebration. That's at Jamesville & Johnson Park Sunday from 4 to 8.
Correct. Yep.
And you'll be spinning.
Yeah, I'll be doing some of the DJing.
Nice.
Yep. With the cast downstairs. Shouts out to Robin Johnson, Maul Jones.
Oh, yeah. Maul Jones.
Yep.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what's coming up on the show this weekend.
Okay. So I have picked three songs. The first one that I want to talk about is Bruce V. Allen. I met him at the Jazz and Jacks event. He's a frat brother. Shouts out to the Alphas. But I met him there, and we met up for lunch, and he gave me his new single. He's a gospel pianist, jazz pianist as well, world-winning and whatnot. So he has a single called Come Back. And I really enjoyed his testimony. He had a very good testimony when we went to lunch. He had a stroke, and then he was rebuilding himself to get back into playing. You know, he said the doctor said he wouldn't play anymore. But, I mean, he has a tremendous album that's out, an EP that's out, came out January. So his testimony, along with the great music, is just beautiful. So that will be playing. That's one of the songs we'll be playing on Saturday.
Excellent. Can we take a listen?
Yeah, definitely.
So kind of, you know, in the beginning of that song, I hear a little bit of Anita Baker almost, like this kind of slow jam 80s R&B sound.
Indeed. It definitely gives off that that type of energy.
Yeah.
So it's good. But it's so good to listen to a testimony of somebody's and then listen to the music that they produce. It's just beautiful. So
is this musical genre something called praise-trumental? Praise songs
praise
that are...
Now, that's something new. I never, but it could, I mean, I could see that being a genre. Everybody's making up new genres these days, so.
But he is a pastor.
He's definitely a pastor, yes.
Yeah.
He's a pastor, an advocate of jazz music, an advocate of gospel music, and just, you know, being very expressive, so I love it.
All right, what's up next?
So we have Blue Lab Beats. So I've been hearing about Blue Lab Beats a while, but they released the album Blue Eclipse. Released last month, and I've been playing their music like ever since it's been out. It's on my playlist, so I wanted to share it with the neighbors. So this one particular song that we're about to listen to is called Guava, but it has A little bit of like that California S type sound, but it's definitely electric. Definitely has a down tempo hip hop to it, but it's really good. It's by two producers. So
all right.
Puts me in California when I hear it.
It's kind of an islandy sound.
Absolutely,
too.
Yeah. So yeah, I've enjoyed the album, but Blue Eclipse is out now, so you can check that out. But that would be the second one of the songs I play on the show as well.
All right, and then Jordan
Raikai. Yeah. So I had to look up his name and listen to an interview and be like, let me make sure I say it correctly. But yeah, he's I've met him. Well, not met him, but I've got introduced to him as a producer. But didn't even know that he was a vocalist as well. And he's from the UK. So he has that UK atmosphere, you know, that type of sound to him. So he's in the likes of like a Tom Misch, FKJ. Those are very good multi-instruments people. And yeah, so it's really good soul and that type of thing. So. You keep on finding those.
Real strong bass line there.
Absolutely. I'm sorry I'm making the scrunched up face, but it's that funk in it. He has that funk as well. It has a very profound type of funk. So that's that bass line definitely comes from that funk atmosphere.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, you can tune into Mr. Al Pete's show, The Neighborhood, every Saturday at 9 p.m. right here on WJCT News 89.9. Thanks, Al, for being here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate y'all.
Have a great weekend.
Indeed.
And that's our program. We encourage you to send your feedback and suggestions to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight. But you can also find our entire archive at WJCT.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to listen Saturday at 4 when neurologist Dr. Joe Servin explores common hand problems and treatments. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett and directed by Brady Corum. Our theme music is performed by Club de Belugas. Join us Monday when we talk with the head of Visit Jacksonville about the tourist climate on the First Coast. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.